Well, I want to thank the organizers for inviting me. And I'm not sure, I don't think I'm one of the organizers, but I should have looked at the list first. Yes, right. Okay, so this will be a very sort of a tour of the area of operator spaces, and it's a very personal tour. I won't be giving references to all the people who are involved in the subject. It's a very selfish point of view that I'll have, namely my prejudices. That's what it is largely a discussion of. And what I want to do is trace just how far back these ideas go. And we'll try actuating this. So from my perspective, the area began with a paper from 1951 by Cadison, in which he was trying to formalize notions from quantum mechanics using functional analysis. And the philosophy behind this began with the Gell von Neumark Siegel theory, and Siegel had a big influence on Cadison, and he tried to carry this program further, this notion that distinguishes classical and quantum mechanics in general. And his point of view was, it wasn't his point of view, but he mathematically formalized it, was to have a linear space of observables and a convex set of states. And there's sort of a combination. You can just, at most elementary level, think of it as evaluating a state on an observable. The observables are a linear space of self-adjoint operators on a Hilbert space, and S is the convex set of states on that space. So as I say here, you could let your A, O could be the self-adjoint elements in a C-star algebra, and S would be the states on that C-star algebra. And Cadison then proved the following facts, or made the, proved and formulated the following notions. He felt that the convex geometry of this state space should determine the order structure of the observables. More specifically, he felt that the convex structure of the state space should somehow encode the C-star algebraic structure of the C-star algebra, more precisely the the Jordan algebraic structure. Notice that we're not working with the full C-star algebra here. We're working with just the self-adjoint elements in the C-star algebras. And in those days, a lot was made of the fact that observables are, in fact, self-adjoint operators rather than general normal operators. And normal operators are not closed under multiplication. I mean, self-adjoint operators are not closed under multiplication, but they are closed under this Jordan product. And it was known that you can classify, for example, the finite dimensional Jordan algebras just like you can classify the finite dimensional C-star algebras. And furthermore, he pointed out this very important connection, how you can recover the self-adjoint elements of the C-star algebra from the state space directly by regarding them as affine functions on the convex set. A continuous function is affine, or a function in general, if it preserves convex combinations. F of alpha A plus 1 minus alpha B is equal to alpha F of A, etc. So that's your, that was the first context in this paper in 1951. But he went much further, and he pointed out that, in fact, this applies to many other situations than just C-star algebras. Now, on this slide, I'm going to explain what my prejudices are on this. Cadison, in this theory, was using Banach spaces and ordered Banach spaces to study quantum systems. And he was necessarily, of course, not talking about quantized functional analysis, which is really what I'm going to be talking about today. And so I say it over here. Cadison's program was largely completed. When I, forgive the misspelling there, what I mean by that is that Cadison was hoping that you could actually recover the C-star algebra from that convex set. or at least the Jordan structure. And this was carried out in a series of papers, remarkable papers by Alfson and Schultz, and together with Sturmer, they played a role in that. And that spans several decades at least, and is a very beautiful area. My point of view, though, is that if you're interested in C-star algebras, you get a much deeper theory of structure if you pay attention to the quantum functional analysis rather than the classical functional analysis. What we want to do is replace Banach spaces by operator spaces, and that's really the topic of this lecture, and how you do that, and what the history of that procedure was. So the claim is that the linear spaces, like the self-adjoint operators on a Hilbert space, have hidden structure, namely the norms and orderings on the matrices. So let's begin with the classical situation, and the easiest one to describe is the notion of a norm space and its quantized version in operator space. Now, a norm space can be redefined to be simply a subspace of L infinity of some set, the bounded functions on a set. This is the mother of all norm spaces. Any norm space sits inside of L infinity of capital omega, because you can let omega just be the unit ball of the dual space. And you can think of your elements of your Banach space as they, of course, determine functions on the dual space. In particular, they determine affine functions on the dual ball. And so in particular, you don't even need the notion of affine. They give you bounded functions on the unit ball. And this is an isometric embedding because of the Hahn-Banach theorem, ultimately. If you have an arbitrary complex Banach space, it's isometric to bounded functions on the unit ball. So when I talk about a function space, and I am only interested in the norm, I'm talking about all Banach spaces. Okay. So abstractly, a function space is just a Banach space. And why is it advantageous? Why introduce Banach spaces at all? I mean, why not always just talk about a function space? This is an illustration of the power of abstraction in mathematics, you might say, a very simple-minded one. Namely, suppose you're interested in function spaces. How do you go about proving that a quotient of function spaces is another function space? The problem is that you're going to have to come up with a completely different set omega there. It can be done. It's not very, very deep. But it's much easier just to argue a quotient of a Banach space by a closed subspace is another Banach space. You don't have to worry about the capital omegas. But that applies on many different levels. For example, what about the dual of a Banach space? Why should the dual of a subspace of L infinity of omega, why should that be the subspace of L infinity of something else? You'd have to come up with that other thing. It's not necessary, because we know that the dual of a Banach space is a Banach space for elementary reasons. Okay. So, and one can continue. For example, there are all sorts of tensor products of Banach spaces that would be very awkward to put in terms of the function spaces. That whole notion is going to explain why we want to find an abstract version of an operator space. This is Rouhan's very nice theorem. So a function space is a real closed. So now that's our notion of how we abstract function spaces. But if you go back to that earlier theory of Kadison, he was really looking not at function spaces, he was looking at function systems. And a function system is has a little bit more structure to it. It is, in fact, both a norm space and an ordered space. But concretely, all you have to do is say that it is a subspace of the real bounded functions on omega, this convenient convention that I'm going to use, and that it contains the identity, the function 1. So it has a very, it has a distinguished unit, or order unit, it's called. And so it's more than just a norm space. It is a vector space with a norm, with an ordering, and with a distinguished unit. In a C-star algebra, if you have the self-adjoint elements of a unital C-star algebra, we have that the the V would be just the self-adjoint linear space of self-adjoint operators. And the, of course, you know what the norm and the ordering is, and we're not paying any attention to algebraic structure. This is purely a geometric theory. And of course we have, I'm saying it's unital C-star algebra, that would be the unit of the C-star algebra. And you'll notice that the norm and the ordering are interconnected, or related, by the fact that something lies between minus 1 and 1, if and only if its supernorm is less than or equal to 1. You can just draw the graph of the function and see that that's the case. If you're working with a concrete, with a function system, a concrete norm space. And you have this technical condition, Archimedean condition is concerned. We won't worry about that. It's just a technical little thing that you have to throw in to really characterize the function systems. So here are some very simple examples of function systems. You could take Rn as regarding it as L infinity of an n-point space. And we have as another example, Catasin's primary example of looking at the self-adjoint elements in a C-star algebra. They can be regarded as the affine functions on the state space of the C-star algebras. And I should have written L infinity. Often people think of the continuous functions on the state space, but there's no special advantage of that. I probably should have written L infinity sub R of the state space. But this game can be played much more generally. Take any convex set at all and look at the affine functions on the convex set. They form a subset of the bounded functions on K. I mean the bounded affine functions over here. And this is a very general way of producing, in fact, it is the most general way, as we'll see in a minute, of producing a function system. You take the affine functions on a convex set. Usually we'll take it to be a compact convex set, and there it's advantageous to think of the continuous functions and using the weak star topology, but let's not worry about that. And now here we run into this difficulty, which did not happen with function spaces. Function systems have the problem that when you take the dual of a function system, it's no longer a function system. The norms and the orderings get screwed up. They don't have the same relationships to each other. And you cannot directly, and it's false that the dual is a function system in any natural sense, or that the quotient is a function system, or that all those different tensor products usually will not be function systems. And a very simple example would be take the dual of L infinity and to get a little L1 and to check that its norm cannot possibly be obtainable from an order unit. So, but there is one aspect, though, that's a little bit more subtle and had a profound impact on the subject, and that is even though the dual of a function system is not a function system, the dual is made up of a lot of function systems. And the way you see that is you take a state, that's a particular point, a positive function on the dual, which sends one to one, a state, and you can construct from that P the hereditary subspace. That P will determine a subspace by taking the difference of two cones. You look at the set of all things dominated by a multiple of P, and you put a norm on this by the same sort of formula we had before, except instead of using 1, we use P as the order unit. And then you find that you have renormed the space. It's the same ordering, but you've renormed it in such a way that you have a function system, so that the dual of a function system contains lots of function systems. WP is the difference of the cones. You see these are just positive elements. So I just want to say that WP is the, it's really the linear span in some sense, the ordered linear span dominated by Q. So what is WP? Let me repeat. First, before defining WP, let FP be all the things in V star which are dominated by a multiple of P. You can think in terms of the Radon-Nikodym theorem, for example, if you were working with the states on a C of X, okay? And so that isn't a linear space. I want to turn it into a linear space. So I'm producing inside of V star a linear subspace, which will turn out to be a function space. It'll have its own state space, which is someplace else, okay? Okay, so that is our local function system. This is an example of a purely abstract function system, which isn't obviously a function system to begin with. So many norm spaces are not obviously function spaces. Here we're in a situation where you have a function system. So it's very nice to have axioms for what a function system is. It has to have an ordering, it has to have an order unit, and the norm and the order has to be related in that manner, which we forced. We've put a new norm on. We've changed the norm on this subspace.
So WP is the set of differences?
Yes, the set of all differences. F minus G will be linear space. And we will see that in the quantum context, that has a very important role. But we're still in the classical context. Remember, we're doing the classical theory, even though Katteson introduced it to study C star algebras. He was using classical Banach algebraic method, Banach functional analysis methods to study C-star algebras. Our morphisms in this context is simply the unital positive mappings. You're all familiar with that, because in particular, channel, is the dual of a channel is precisely a morphism, okay, for the appropriate spaces. So what is a morphism? We're interested not in the if we were norm spaces, the morphisms would presumably be the contractions. We're taking very special contractions. They're those which are positive and unital. It turns out that means it's a contraction. It's easy to prove. And in particular, a state is nothing but a morphism from V into the reals. Okay? And here I have that classical channel, the notion of a channel over here. And but here we come to the fact that, in fact, the fact that compact convex sets are dual to function spaces. You can study all compact convex sets by studying function spaces or conversely. Because if you're given a function space, function systems are one-to-one correspondence with compact convex sets. We have that a function system can be identified with the affine functions on its state space. Given any compact convex set in any locally convex space, you can recover that convex set as the state spaces of the affine functions on the state space of V. I should write S of the affine functions of K. Okay. My point is, though, that these are in one-to-one correspondence, compact convex sets and function systems. Now, of course, the main theorem in the subject of functional analysis began with the Hahn-Banach theorem in a fancy version of the Hahn-Banach theorem. The Hahn-Banach theorem would have the complex numbers over here. If you have a linear functional, which is, let's say, I'm looking at the ordered Hahn-Banach theorem, the Klein-Hahn-Banach theorem. If you have a morphism from W into the reals, it can always be extended from V into the reals. I'm in a real space situation, you'll recall, when I do function spaces, function systems. That this extension always exists, I should have said, which it's a morphism. It sends one to one, and it's positive. That automatically means phi will be a contraction with lift to a contraction. This is a version of the Hahn-Banach theorem. But I put it in this more general context. What about a more general thing than the reals, a one-dimensional function space? And that's a very old theory. What's these can be placed here? Well, there are very few things that can be put there, very few operator systems. And roughly speaking, if they are a dual space, they're at capital L infinity of some measure space. There are very few Banach spaces with that property. You can't put the n by n matrices there, for example. And here's a little fact that we'll talk about later. If you have a function system, its second dual is injective, has that property if and only if the state space of V is a showcase simplex. You don't have to know what that means. those who know, it might help to orient them. Now, the claim is that the way to understand this type of theory is with tensor products. I won't go through that advertisement. People in QIT are quite comfortable with tensor products. I don't have to go through that routine. But algebraically speaking, if you want, think of two finite dimensional vector spaces in duality, and one is the dual of the other, say, doesn't matter which order. And you can think of the tensor product as a mapping space. This was Grothendieck's philosophy. You should be studying simultaneously different types of tensor products and different types of mapping spaces. Say, for example, the absolutely summing mappings must correspond to some particular type of tensor product, or the nuclear maps, or the on and on. But this is a purely algebraic situation. Why should you think of a tensor product as a mapping? Well, here we are. If you have V tensor W and you apply it to a linear functional F, I'm taking a specific example of U, namely V tensor W, the corresponding mapping says take F, evaluate it at V, and multiply by W. This is something you do all the time, maybe unconsciously, but I'm sure everybody has seen something like this. And another identification is if you look at the dual of V tensor W, you can think of those as linear mappings from V into W, the dual of W. You're turning tensor products into mapping spaces. And the way you do that, of course, is if you're given a function F in this dual space, how can you get a mapping out of this function? Everybody in QIT knows this, is you just evaluate your function in order to figure out what this is, ask what it does. It's getting mapped into the dual of W, so you have to explain what this does to an element W. Well, you just take F of the tensor product, V and W. That's a very simple rule. Okay, a little bit more abstract theory. I'm sure you're familiar with cones and vector spaces, and if you have a subset of a vector space, you can take you can always find a smallest cone containing it. Given linear spaces in duality, each set T determines a dual cone, the functions which are positive on it. That's a very simple-minded set of notions. And now I'm going to tell you how to order a tensor product of two vector spaces. There's a minimal one and a maximal one. Namely, you can take the smallest cone that contains elementary tensors, that's what I mean by that, drawn from the two cones, or you can go to the dual space, take the smallest cone containing the elementary tensors in the dual cones, and then taking the dual cone of that. You're taking a cone of a cone, okay? And that will give you a different tensor product. This all sounds like abstract nonsense. I was driving with my wife, it was our first sort of a honeymoon trip cross country, and we went through Seattle, and I happened to meet Namioka and Phelps for the first time, and they were working on Catasin's theory. And that's where this theory intersected with my own career. They showed me what they had done thus far, and I suggested to them, it was completely wild guess. I said, maybe this is like with nuclear topological vector spaces, that there are certain spaces in that theory, they're different tensor products. But there's certain spaces, I guess it's the nuclear ones, such that when you tensor them with anything, the two tensor products agree, all the tensor products agree. So maybe something like that's true in this context. And that's what they were able to prove. Namely, if you have two function systems, I wish I could correct it on the screen. They were working with function systems, they're ordered, and you have two tensor products determined by those two ways of ordering the tensor product. I always get it mixed up which one goes with which one, but you have a minimal tensor product and a maximal tensor product, which are usually different. But what you can do, and this is what they were primarily interested in, was, look, you've got these convex sets. This is the most general convex compact set there is. It must be there's a way of taking tensor products of convex compact sets. There's a minimal or a maximal, and I always get mixed minimal and maximal mixed up. But there are two ways of taking a tensor product, K1 and K2. So here's their theorem. They showed the following are equivalent in a function system. Hurrah, I finally said system. The minimal and maximal tensor products are the same for all W. V double star is an injective function system, and the state space of V is a showcase simplex. That's what I had conjectured to them. And they went on to show that you really only have to test your convex set against one convex set, the square. You only have to check the two tensor products are the same for the square. If they're the same for the square, then indeed you have a very special type of V, the V for which the state space is a showcase simplex. These are called simplex spaces earlier. What we want is the quantized version of that. Now, in this theory, and you'll forgive me for doing all this classical mathematics because I haven't talked about quantization yet, the key role is played, which they observed, was played by the fact that if you have a state on this maximal tensor product, it determines a linear mapping from V into the double, the dual of W. That was a general algebraic fact. Linear functional on a tensor product gives a mapping of the first space into the dual of the second space. And furthermore, the image of the unit can be used to generate a function system. See, W star is not a function system, but it has these local function systems determined by particular states, for example. Hence, we have a mapping into, between two function systems. You stay in the same category rather than going to a more complicated situation. It's the quantized version of this thing that led to the results that really had a profound effect on operator algebra theory. It began with a paper of Lance in which he was studying what were called nuclear C-star algebras for the same formal reason. And Choi and myself, Lance, I work with Lance and with Choi on this. You can find a history of this, if you like, in this paper from years ago. And what we did was we looked at the quantized version of the Kelly-Namioka theory. And what happened was, this was very successful, as we'll see in a second. But then, 10 years later, Hagra pointed out you shouldn't be studying just ordered spaces, ordered unit spaces, you should be studying the norm spaces. And you get a whole new set of invariants, what are called the transnuclear or transamenable spaces, C-star algebras. So how do we quantize? Everybody here knows that. You replace functions by operators, and you decide what your natural mappings are. So a function space, which is just a subspace of L infinity, is replaced by a linear space of bounded operators on a Hilbert space. Bounded mappings go into completely bounded mappings. There is your analog of a norm space. It's an operator space. It's a subspace of B of H. But just as it's very artificial to think of norm spaces as subspaces of L infinity, because it's extremely awkward to prove things like quotients are stable, you also want to find an abstract version of this. In any event, that's what Ruan's theorem has to do with. So we have function spaces go to operator spaces, function systems go to operator systems. So here we have a function system, a subspace of this with a unit, going into, here we replace real by just a self-adjoint subspace of complex B of H containing a unit. And so there is your translation, your quantization. And of course, channels go over to quantum channels under this sort of context. And in this dual theory, whereas state spaces were universal compact convex sets, the claim is that matrix state spaces are universal matrix convex sets, which I won't pursue in this talk. So how, what, now the claim is that when you do this quantization, the trickiest part of all is recognize this hidden structure. In the case of a Banach space, let's look at a Banach space. There is structure there, but it's very trivial. Namely, if you have an n-tuple of functions, it gives you a new function on the n copies of omega space in this obvious way. N functions, you let f1 act on the first, f2 on the second, etc. So that means that the n-tuples are a function space on n omega, But it's trivial because the norm of the n-tuple is just the maximum of the fk's. F is larger than or equal to 0 if and only the fk's are larger than or equal to 0. It's when you get to matrices, to operators, that changes drastically. And that's because you do the analogous argument. An n by n matrix of operators on H is an operator on H to the n. You just use matrix multiplication. This is the analog of that. But now we have that Mn of V is contained, instead of C of n omega, it's B of H to the n, and H plus itself n times. The key distinction is you can't get the norm of the matrix from the norm of the Vij's. There's a floppiness there. There's additional structure which has to be acknowledged by the morphism. The norm and the ordering on the n by n matrices are not determined by the norm and or ordering on V. That's the operator space structure. So that our morphisms, here I'm just repeating what I said, if you have a morphism from V to W in our, let's say, linear mapping, from V to W, we won't worry about the ordered case first, it determines a mapping from the n by n matrices to the n by n matrices, and you have to acknowledge the norms of these mappings as well. In fact, what you should do, that n should be inside the norm there, phi sub n. The completely bounded norm of phi, you take the sup over all of them. If you take the transpose mappings of the 2 by 2 matrices to the 2 by 2 matrices, you look at its doubled version. The transpose is isometric. Its doubled version is not isometric. And you can do a similar argument with the ordering, too. You get screwed up. Okay, so here's this notion of completely bounded. You demanded all these things. I'm sure you've all seen this by now. You demand that the sup of these things be bounded. That's your completely bounded norm. And you also have a notion of complete positivity. You demand that all the phi n's be larger than or equal to 0. And so we define a morphism between two operator systems to be positive, completely positive mapping, which is unital. And of course, you have the quantum channels, are the adjoints of the quantum morphisms. And so the claim is that the operator spaces are exactly the quantized norm spaces. And that was the theory which began with Rouen's characterization of the quantum norm spaces. What you demand is norms on the n. The structure involves every one of these has to be taken into consideration, and the norm relates to the order. You have to have this. This replaces the usual axioms of a norm space. This is the direct sum of two matrices, diagonal direct sum, and here you have a scalar matrix scalar. They have to be appropriately sized matrices. These can be rectangular, and that's all you have to assume. That automatically means that your space can be identified with a linear subspace of B of H. There's no Hilbert space around. So you might wonder, where does the Hilbert space come from? It's just a vector space. And that was the beauty of Rouen's argument. And then you discover you're suddenly free. Everything is an operator space. You take quotients, duals, they're all operator spaces. You don't have to explain why they are operator spaces, because they satisfy the norm axioms. I should point out that one of the subtleties in this is that just as the bounded maps from one Banach space to another Banach space form another Banach space, the n by n matrices over the completely bounded maps from V into W can be identified with the completely bounded maps from V into the n by n matrices over W. You might wonder, why do I put it on this side? It becomes obvious when you look at the normed space situation, but let's not worry about that. In particular, the dual of an operator space is an operator space. What was the history of complete boundedness, complete positivity? Of course, in our very early theorem, the first one which explicitly introduced that ordering, I mean, Neumark had an earlier theorem which he didn't introduce, the matrix ordering, but here the first explicit ordering notion of complete positivity, I believe, was in Steinspring's version, which you are all very familiar with. And then the next big theorem, which is really what got me into the area, was Arvidsson's Hahn-Banach theorem. Actually, he didn't completely prove the result for the linear case, for the normed case. Wittstock filled in the last part of that. So you have a Hahn-Banach theorem for operator systems and for operator spaces. And again, you have this notion that some C-star algebras can be used as a target instead of the n-by-n matrices. The Arvidsson-Hahn-Banach theorem had you mapping into the n-by-n matrices rather than into the complex numbers. So here we map into the n-by-n matrices. That wouldn't work if you didn't take into consideration complete boundedness, because it's not an injective Banach space, the n-by-n matrices. And then the key result from my point of view, which really convinced me there was something to be done here, was Lance wrote this beautiful paper on nuclear C-star algebras, and the key result he used is that if you take a state on the maximal tensor product of two C-star algebras, it corresponded to a completely positive mapping from A into B star. That was the first indication that complete positivity of the dual space was important, not just of the space itself. You had to look at the matrix orderings on the dual space. And then, since I knew the Kelly and Amioka theory, I said, look, it must be there are local operator spaces, and we wrote a paper together taking advantage of the fact that you can actually find in that dual C-star algebra these local operator systems, which in fact are von Neumann algebras. That was our observation. You can show that this thing over here by the GNS theory that relates extreme points, for example, to irreducible representation. This is just a version of that. That this thing is in fact, this sits inside of a vector space, and in fact it is a von Neumann algebra. Okay, that led to the notion of semi-discreteness for von Neumann algebras, what people were trying to do in those days was find out what are the injective C-star algebras, or more specifically the injective dual C-star algebras, the injective von Neumann algebras. And Kahn's great, this is the biggest theorem of some decades, was Kahn's characterization of the injective von Neumann algebras as just the limits of finite dimensional algebras. And then what I proved with Choi and Kirchberg independently proved it, is that a C-star algebra is nuclear, that's like that simplex space stuff, if and only the second dual is injective. And finally, what we proved was that your injectives are those for which there's an approximation property. This is now the C-star algebra situation, not the Kahn situation. He had this approximation by finite dimensional von Neumann algebras. Here is the characterization of the nuclear C-star algebras. You have approximate factorizations of the identity map. And what completely changed the whole perspective was that some years later, 1978, Hagerup discovered that if you change your category and only look at completely bounded mappings, completely bounded morphisms, say, or just completely bounded contractions, into finite dimensional spaces, you would get a new approximation for a C-star algebra that was clearly not nuclear, the free C-star algebra, the free group on N generators. So that's how it came out of the purely classical theory. But this was a revelation to me. I'd always thought that, oh, the norm space theory will just be an obvious generalization. Never take anything for granted. And this led to a whole new class of invariants, of the invariants that go beyond amenability, which is considered old hat today. But we have notions for C-star algebras of exactness, local reflexivity. I can list 5 or 6 properties, which are completely new properties. They're completely non-classical because every Banach space has the classical analog of those properties, like local reflexivity. But C-star algebras bifurcates. It's not one of these computational bifurcations. It was for very important conceptual reasons. It wasn't doing some very complicated asymptotic construction. It was using the fact of non-ability, non-amenability, property T. All of those things come into the theory. I'm overstating it, but you'll forgive me. I'm an enthusiast. Okay. The liberation, but for me, the most important, and I'm too much engaged with concepts, but to me, the most important part of this quantum functional analysis is it liberated, well, these results liberated functional analysis from operator algebra theory in a sense. Remember that Banach spaces are not studied because you're interested in commutative C-star algebras, say, or even C-star algebras. They're studied because Banach spaces are of interest in themselves. And the point is that you know the dual of an operator space is an operator space. There's no reason to be thinking about C star algebras. Any place where a Banach space occurs, there should be a non-commutative version. So, for example, with the theory of harmonic analysis where you have Fourier algebras. When you have a Fourier algebra, you shouldn't be studying the bounded representations. You get a good theory only if you study the completely bounded representations. You have to acknowledge the underlying structure. Those Fourier algebras are commutative. They're trivial from a classical functional analysis point of view, in a sense. And then, so there's a big, big development of all of this. And so here are places where they occur, harmonic analysis, non-commutative boundaries, where Arvidsson is continuing to do fantastic work, and he and his collaborators, non-self-adjoint operator algebras, non-commutative LP spaces. That should be, I got the right name, okay, good. All these tensor products, and then all the tensor products, the whole Grothendieck program generalized. So we've got integral mappings, we've got the Grothendieck theorem, probably the deepest theorem of Banach spaces, has a non-commutative analog, which is much more sophisticated and much more remarkable than Grothendieck's original theorem. And something that I did with Marius and Ruan was there are remarkable surprises. Not all things are negative. If you take any von Neumann algebra, its pre-dual is always locally reflexive. Von Neumann algebras, C-star algebras need not be reflexive, but you go to the dual space, it's a completely different situation. This theory makes sense much more generally. And then you come to this notion of the quantizations of a norm space. Any norm space sits inside of L infinity, which is a von Neumann algebra, and therefore is an operator system. It sits inside of B, or operator space. So therefore, you can quantize this by considering it as a subspace of this. You get the minimal and the maximal tensor products. That should be, say, max over there. Oh, no, this is the functor into minimal tensor. There's a quantization. Every space has a quantization. That is a way of putting norms on all the n by n matrices. And there's a maximal one that was introduced by Bletcher and Paulson. And to illustrate that, if you want to look at the minimum space of L1n, that's not a function system, the minimum of this thing here is the span of the generators of the continuous functions on the classical torus. The maximal one is the span of the generators of the C-star algebra on the non-commutative torus, the C-star algebra of the free group on N generators. Okay, so quantum information theory, and I haven't said very much about that, even though this is a conference on quantum information theory, is having an increasing impact on this whole theory. In particular, it is bringing back the theory of operator systems. When we generalized this theory, the Kelly-Namioka theory, we deliberately avoided the true generalization and restricted ourselves to C-star algebras rather than with operator systems. C-star algebras, unital C-star algebras, are perfectly good operator systems, but there are many more of them. And so we didn't do that because we didn't think that operator systems, once again, never take anything for granted. We didn't think operator systems had any applications at all. So that's why I was so surprised to see this latest paper of Paulson with his two collaborators, in which they show there's an analog of the min and the max quantizations of function systems to operator systems. Remember that this already existed in the case of function spaces to operator spaces. You have the min-max. Here we're going from function systems to operator systems, which have the expected properties. And finally, let's say something about quantum information theory. Here's their result, which I think is intersects certainly with what Sturmer has been doing, showing the importance of these theories. A mapping from MN to MM is entanglement breaking. I really have to learn that. If and only if the corresponding mappings from these things are an operator morphism. Automatically, you'll have it going the other way. But if you have this perverse direction, it means that it is entangled. That's equivalent to being entanglement breaking. So the next step is to find a full analog, complete analog, of the Kelly-Namioka theorem. It should be possible to prove something which we know in the C-star algebraic context for general operator systems. We already know how to order. There are two obvious tensor products to take on V1 and V2, and there should be a notion of nuclearity in this context, this more general context. I don't know how that might affect quantum information theory, but it's an obvious thing motivated by quantum information theory. So here I say something a little bit more general. The local theory will shed some light. This is going the other way. It's my own feeling that the one thing I don't fully understand in my attempts to learn quantum information theory completely by myself, there's nobody else at UCLA thinks about these things, is this purification methods are very beautiful, but I don't think that one has a final conceptual framework for that procedure. They're very elegant arguments, which must have some sort of analog to the theory of to the old Choquet theory, for example, but it's sort of a dual theory, which doesn't exist. Nothing like it exists in the classical situation. And I would like to suggest that that would have a big impact clarifying on quantum information theory and giving a whole new approach to quantized functional analysis. So thank you for listening.